This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Thank you very much, Roger. And it's a beautiful morning in Huntley. And I, as you said, I hope it stays dry at least until 3:30 this afternoon, because they'll have a two-hour parade kicking off about 1 o'clock in Harvard today for the 75th anniversary of Harvard Milk Day. So we'll try to keep the rain away for that, and we'll talk about a lot of other June Dairy Month activities this morning, because that is one of the longest-running commodity festival program, promotion programs, I think, in the history of the country, June Dairy Month. So you know my line for June Dairy Month: take a cow to lunch, and thank the dairy farm families who take care of the cows, who produce all of the good products that come from milk. A good morning to the folks at Lake Zurich yesterday, who joined us for the opening of the farmers market at Lake Zurich. Mayor Tom Poynton was there and helped open it as we cut the ribbon. Great location for a farmer's market. It's on a lake, a park on the lake. Great location. And let me say one thing about farmer's markets this time of the year. It's not all locally grown. As a matter of fact, I know some farmers who have farms in southern Indiana and in Kentucky and places like that, who actually live here and farm here in the Chicagoland area, but they have those farms so they can get vegetables and other produce ready earlier and then truck them into the farmers markets here. But over the next few weeks, farmers markets will be, well, more local farmers for the Chicago area. The thing I like about, there are many things I like about farmers markets, but one of them is the fact you have an opportunity to talk to the people who put food on your table. And there are so many misconceptions today on what farmers and ranchers do with the environment and with their fields and with their livestock. You need to meet these people and talk to them. They're not as bad as PETA would have you believe, or the Humane Society of the United States would have you believe. So go to a farmer's market, enjoy the produce, but enjoy visiting with people who put food on the table. And if you enjoy gardening and if you enjoy landscaping and all of that, guess who's standing by? Jim Fizell, our specialist in ornamental horticulture, standing by, and he'll join us when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Well, he survived the Memorial Day holiday and the continuing rains and everything else that's going on. How is your garden growing, Jim Fizell?
I haven't had my canoe out to find out. It's wet. This spring we did quite a bit of work to raise some of the areas that, for some peculiar reason, have become wet over the decades, and we put a lot more topsoil in, recontoured the thing. So far, no standing water, and stuff seems to be doing okay. That hasn't happened all the time. In fact, for a couple of years now, we've had parts of the crop that drowned out. I don't think that's going to happen this year, but our fingers are still crossed.
Well, share with me a phone call or a message that you got from a listener.
Well, this listener said, hey, aren't you jumping the gun? What about those of us out here who have never gardened before and we're just going to start? Are we too late, and how do we do it? We don't know. You talk about it as if people have already started, and that's true. We've kind of neglected these new folks. And we have folks coming every year that are starting gardening. It's like when you teach. You say, well, I taught that 2 years ago. Well, it's new students, folks. Anyway, we have new folks out there that are just beginning to think about gardening, why they're doing it now, or whatever, so their situations have changed. Maybe they bought a house with a big yard or whatever. Anyway, it's not too late to start gardening. The kids are just now getting out of school, and weather has really just warmed up with only in the last couple of weeks. And if we can get through some of this rain, get things to dry out a little bit, it's an excellent time to start gardening. In fact, those of us who have gardens in already may be suffering because of excess water, and those of you who are going to start in just a little bit don't have to worry about that. So getting started, what is the first thing you need to do? You need to find a spot for your garden, a location. First of all, it needs to be convenient. If you have a big yard, you need to have it near water, or at least where you can get a hose out to do some watering. It needs to be near enough the house that you don't have to actually take a trip out to get to your garden. It needs to be near enough to the house so that you can bring things in, because sometimes things like boxes of tomatoes will be a little bit heavy. And very important that it does not intrude on the living part of your yard, because some of these gardens can be unsightly, and that's the way they are. Sun is important. That's the energy that you use to grow things. If you have full sun, you'll get a full crop. Full sun, we're talking about essentially 8 or more hours a day. If you have less than full sun, you'll have less than a full crop. Not that you can't garden in less than full sun. You can. You just have to remember that it's going to be a little bit different, and instead of getting full crop out of things, you may not get as much stuff, and the plants will tend to get a little bit taller. You want to be sure that you're not near trees or shrubs, not just because of the shade, but because of the root systems that will get out into your garden. They're going to compete with your garden crops for the nutrients and water that are out there. Decent soil. If you have a normal soil that we have in this part of the country, it's fairly heavy, which is okay. That doesn't matter. That can be modified. The other thing that you need to have is good drainage. And one way to check that would be to dig a hole, maybe a foot or so deep, fill it up with water, and see how fast the water runs out of it. If it runs out within a short period of time, your drainage is good enough for gardens. All right, what do you want to grow? First of all, you want to grow something the family will eat. We had a friend that grew a lot of eggplant, and he was the only one in the family that would eat it. So he had more than enough eggplant for everybody, but they wouldn't touch the stuff. So you need to figure out what the family will eat. If they like tomatoes and they like broccoli and so forth, that's what you're going to want to grow. The most productive things for the time and effort would be tomatoes, first of all, especially tomatoes grown in cages or up on poles, pole beans, bush squash, green peppers, which will turn red or yellow or whatever if you let them on long enough, things like green onions, which grow very quickly, and then some of the things that you can seed would be like beets. Anyway, if you need recommendations for what will grow in this area, there are a lot of books out there. There are bulletins that come out of the University of Illinois and from the Botanic Garden and the Morton Arboretum that will list things that are suitable for this area. Now, once you've figured out where you're going to put your garden, you need to draw it to scale on graph paper. The size needs to fit your available time. Incidentally, it needs to be small enough that you can handle it, because the weeds that are going to grow in there will astound you, and if you don't get out there quick, you're going to have a weed garden instead of a vegetable garden. And weeds separate the good gardeners from the bad. They cause most of the failures, and you don't want to be a part of that. You don't want to plan on much help from your kids, because they're going to be busy on their own. They've got soccer and swimming and girlfriends and so forth, so you're going to be left to do this by yourself. A 10-foot by 10-foot garden is a good starting size. It's 100 square feet. You can either grow in rows across the garden, or you can make beds, and 3 beds will fit in this 10 by 10 garden. So you need to be very careful that you, first of all, lay it out so that you get a maximum amount of sun. And generally, we say that if you want a maximum amount of sun, you need to run your rows as close to east and west as you can. It will work other ways, but that will give you the most light for what you're doing. You need to grow in vertical gardens to save space. We talked about the cages for tomatoes. Beans on poles. Vines on trellises. Plant the taller kinds to the north side, because you don't want them shading the smaller ones. Laying out the garden. Follow the plan once you've got your garden on graph paper. Go out and measure the area, set stakes at the corners, lay out the rows or beds with strings, and then you need to be sure that you get rid of the weeds that are there now. You can hoe them out, or you can put Roundup on them, which incidentally works very well, and it will kill those weeds, and you don't have to worry about it being around to hurt any of your garden crops, because as soon as it kills the weeds, it's gone. Apply starter fertilizer, turn your garden over with a spading fork. Make sure the soil is dry enough before you do that. Then break out the lumps and so forth, and you're ready to start seeding or transplanting. This late in the season, probably transplants of tomatoes and peppers are best, but you can still seed beans or beets and some of the vine crops. cover the seed with a board to protect it in case we get baking sun or pounding rain, and wait for the seeds to come up. Now, we're going to run out of time today, but we're going to continue this little discussion later. Maybe next week we'll have time to do that, and we're going to cover some other kinds of gardens as well, like container gardening. But anyway, that's enough for people to worry about right now. Resources, we do have lots of fruit and vegetable books that are out. Our Illinois edition is out. It's available, not in bookstores anymore, but you can get it online. And if you have other questions, just ask. Send them along to us here at WGN, and we'll field them for you. We appreciate you asking questions. It keeps us up on what's happening out there.
All right, my friend. Thank you very much. We look forward. Well, as a matter of fact, we'll take them all the way through harvest in your next discussion, okay?
That's fine. We can do that. You bet. <That's, laughs> Let's hope we're harvesting it.
Absolutely. That's Jim Pizzell. He is our specialist in ornamental horticulture here on the Saturday Morning Show.
Coming up to 21 minutes after 5 on a beautiful morning here in Huntley, sunrise brightening the eastern sky, temperature 63 degrees, ideal for going to a lot of activity and events or just enjoying gardening. That was Gardening 101 by Jim Pizzell, followed up by Lou, who is also talking about a product to help you garden. But the one thing I want to say, part of gardening is work, because farming is work. And so quit looking for all of the easy ways to do it and do it the way we did years ago. It was work to hoe the weeds and to nurture the crops and to get them to move along. So next week, Jim Pizzell will finish his Gardening 101 by going to the growing season and then ultimately the harvest season. One organization among the many that we respect and cover throughout the year is American AgriWomen, becoming a major force in trying to determine policy for agriculture. That's why I want to mention the fact that the American AgriWomen are going to Washington, D.C. for their annual visit with congressmen and senators and to help educate the Washington community about the business of farming and ranching. And it's their annual event out there. They'll be arriving tomorrow. They'll be there through Wednesday, the 8th of June. Some interesting topics on the program. Well, they started tomorrow evening at 5 o'clock with the legislative fly-in reception. But then an Ag Issues Symposium on Monday, June 6th, Monday afternoon, will talk about the rippling effects of aquifer depletion. Concern about the Ogallala Aquifer and the other underground water supplies that eventually reach the surface to grow our crops. And then on Tuesday, June 7th, they'll meet with congressmen and senators and their agricultural aides at a reception, getting underway at 4:30 in Washington, D.C. So best wishes to American AgriWomen for the work that they do in continuing to work for policies that will keep farmers and ranchers in business. 23 minutes after 5 o'clock now, and besides June Dairy Month, there are some events. World Pork Expo in Des Moines, Iowa, that gets underway next Wednesday. It's a three-day show. And then at the end of the month, June 22nd to the 23rd, it's the annual Hay and Forage Expo. Now, that will be in Boone, Iowa. And talking to the manager of that show, Matt Youngman, recently, I mentioned the fact that, well, you've been in Iowa with this show before.
Yeah, this will be our third pass through Central Iowa Expo as the host facility for Hay Expo. And the thing that's exciting about that is it allows the exhibitors to do a better job rather than when we're out in a hay field down a gravel road somewhere, you know, there's no internet, there's no electricity, there's obviously no paved roads or any of that kind of thing. So when you have that at Central Iowa Expo, the exhibitors can really do a nice job of putting their exhibits together. And it fits naturally with using what are typically the parking lots during Farm Progress Show. That's a perfectly good field of alfalfa that we can go out and run field demonstrations on that parking lot area. So it fits well, gives the exhibitors a good place to put up the exhibits. And you know, you never know what Mother Nature's going to throw at us in the middle of June, towards the end of June. So having storm sewer drainage and hard surface roads, it just makes it a more comfortable experience for the visitor.
Helps weatherproof you a little bit compared to being out on a farm somewhere in Minnesota or Wisconsin or northeast Iowa, where it's not quite as protected from those heavy rains of which you speak.
Yeah, you know, we have permanent buildings. Our office will be in the Morton building, and you know, we've all been through, anybody who's been to a couple of hay expos has been to one where it's been awful wet and really tough to get around. So having those paved roads and that storm sewer and all those things that make the facility so nice, really real nice amenities, permanent restrooms, you know, all those kind of things that make it a more comfortable show to visit.
Let me ask you about something before we get into more of the mechanics of the show. When you have a dairy market under pressure the way it is now, and milk producers are in kind of a tough situation, especially given the fact that grain prices have bumped up, does that diminish the interest in making good quality hay, or does it underscore their need to make sure they've got the best forage they have and that they're bringing the highest efficiency they can possibly get to the production of milk?
Well, I think whether we're talking about irrigation at Husker Harvest Days or corn and soybean production at Farm Progress Show or quality hay production at the Hay Expo, all these trade shows are about exactly what you're talking about, and that is giving the grower the opportunity to learn about what is the new technology, what are the new tools, what's the new equipment that's going to make me more profitable. So I think it's just as valuable, if not more valuable, in a down dairy economy to come to an event like this, come to a trade show like this, and learn about what's going to make you that extra nickel that's going to help make everything flow well for your family farm.
What about folks who produce for the equine market? Will you find some of them as well at Hay Expo, who really try to serve that market, again, where there's quite an interest in quality forage?
Well, yes. You know, you look at, you know, when we're trying to have a hay and forage expo, you would think about dairy farmers, you'd think about equine, you'd think about cow-calf producers, you know, any sort of forages that need to be produced. You know, we have small square bale accumulators for the equine market, you know, big squares, big rounds, all those kind of things in the baling demonstrations. But it kind of runs the gamut from dairy through to equine to cow-calf that all of this equipment has its application for each one of those folks.
It really is a good central spot to see all of the haying equipment, isn't it? I mean, you could wind up running a lot of different places to see the variety. I mean, from tedders to windrowers, you'd run yourself to death.
You would, and you know, that's kind of the beauty that place. Really, that exhibit field empties when those field demonstrations start, because I don't know of very many places that you can go. If you're in the market to buy, let's say, a mower conditioner, there are very few places you can go and watch 15 or 20 mower conditioners run side by side, one after the other, in the exact same conditions. And so it's a pretty tremendous buying opportunity, or, you know, shopping opportunity, and compare, because you may not necessarily have a, you know, a Vermeer dealer nearby, or a Kuhn dealer nearby, or anything like that. But you really want to take a look at what that equipment can do. You know, a Krohn dealer nearby. But, you know, you've heard that maybe they've got a piece of equipment that would be good for you. This is a chance to go and actually see it run.
The size of the dairy farms that have been built in our region over the past decade or so, it's rather impressive. But they have very large forage demands, don't they? I mean, when you get into the summer and you go down the road and you see what's happening out in some of these fields in terms of bringing in the silage and forage, there are some big machines that are operating out there.
Yeah. You know, as a kind of a corn and soybean guy, to see these big machines run, you know, the we're not going to run choppers, but there will be choppers there on display. And, you know, you're talking about, some of these are approaching 1,000 horsepower. They are massive machines, and they're very impressive to see run. And you know, even 45 feet of hay cut in one pass with three mounted sickle mowers or disc mowers is really, really an impressive sight to see. You know, just as impressive as seeing combines run at Husker Harvest Days.
Matt Youngman, and Matt has been with the Farm Progress Companies and now Penton Agriculture for 21 years working on shows. In addition to the Hay and Forage Expo he talked about, he also is the managing director, the boss at the Farm Progress Show that will be held in Boone, Iowa this year, August 30, 31, and September 1. And he also puts together, as he mentioned, Husker Harvest Days and other special events for Penton Agriculture. We're coming up to news time at 5:30. We're going to be talking the milk market, the milk price market, the dairy market, if you will, on this first Saturday of June Dairy Month. So stay with us for that as we continue on the Saturday morning show. We're at the 5:30 mark now. And thank you for joining us on Chicago's very own 720 WGN and WGNradio.com. And we're at 26 minutes before 6 o'clock. Start to a beautiful day, and as Roger mentioned, it could change with some more moisture later on, but let's hope it holds off until, let me see, I think the parade for Harvard Milk Days will probably be over about 3 o'clock. Generally a 2-hour parade getting underway at 1, and, it's tradition. This is the 75th year for this event in Harvard, Illinois. Tradition for them to whitewash Main Street so that indeed, the parade marchers will be going down the Milky Way. And many times we would do the old noon show on stage on the Milky Way before the parade would get underway. So a lot of great memories of Harvard Milk Day. The breakfast gets underway at 10 o'clock this morning. Gloria and I will be there, and I'll be emceeing the program for the breakfast this morning. Also, of course, with June Dairy Month underway, a lot of breakfast on the farm, and people have been emailing saying, where do we find out about where they are? And generally, the best way to do is to go to the website of the Department of Agriculture in your state. Wisconsin has more breakfasts on the farm than any other state in the country, and there's a website on the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture that addresses the schedule of Dairy Month breakfasts on the farm. Here in Illinois, in 2 weeks from right now, we'll be at the Drendel Dairy Farm in Hampshire, Illinois. That's just south of I-90 and west of Highway 47. The Drendel family, again, opening up the farm from 6 to 11 a.m. You can see cows being milked. You can pet baby calves. You can learn all about the equipment and machinery it takes to produce the feed for the dairy cows that produce the milk. All of that plus a Dairy Month breakfast. And the Dairy Month breakfast will require an $8 donation from adults to continue dairy education programs across the state. So that's June 18th. Oh, and there we will have books to sell and sign. I'll be there with You Can't Dream Big Enough, and Steve and Johnny will be there with their book on Les Paul. So that'll be from 8 till about 10:30, 2 weeks from today, and we look forward to that. Steve Alexander and Diane are publishers, and of course Steve, who fills in for me on WGN Radio from time to time. We'll all be at the Drendel Dairy Farm 2 weeks from today, so come join us. Now it's time for Samuelson Says. I'm Orion Samuelson. This week, looking at a victory for property owners in the highest court of the land. You know, I'm delighted to be on the air for Wink Products Company, have been for many years, because Wink's Products Company is one of those Midwest success stories. Wink, a family-owned corporation in rural Eldora, Iowa. It has manufactured specialty cleaning products ever since 1947. And today, Wink is a nationally recognized brand because, well, Wink products work. Wink manufactures professional strength household cleaners and drain openers for you. So learn all about the Wink products at wink.com, WHINK.com. Now, Samuelson Says. Over the past few decades, owners of property in the United States have watched a steady erosion in their rights as property owners,
government agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency, the Endangered Species Act, the Bureau of Land Management, WOTUS, Waters of the U.S., Army Corps of Engineers, and OSHA, all getting into play on what rights you really do have with the property that you own. Many court cases lost on behalf of property owners until a few days ago when they won a major victory in the highest court of the land, the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled that property owners can go to court to challenge government decisions over whether a wetland or a stream is subject to the permitting requirements of the Clean Water Act. The case, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers versus Hawks Company, located in Marshall County, Minnesota. That's a company that mines peat and wanted to discharge material into wetlands on their property. They were told they couldn't do it. But the Pacific Legal Foundation went to court and were successful. The U.S. Supreme Court gave landowners a meaningful way to challenge wrongful applications of the Clean Water Act. And according to M. Reed Harper, the principal attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation, which represented the Hawks businesses, it's a triumph for property rights, for simple fairness, and for the rule of law. Mr. Hopper went on to say, for more than 40 years, millions of landowners nationwide have had no meaningful way to challenge wrongful application of the Federal Clean Water Act to their land. They have been put at the mercy of the government because land covered by the act is subject to complete federal control. But all that changed today, he said. The Supreme Court ruled that wetlands' jurisdictional determinations can be immediately challenged in court. So, property owners, you finally won one in the courtroom. And I would guess that you're going to continue to work to retain your rights with the property you own. My thoughts on Samuelson Says.
Sponsored by Wink Products Company, Samuelson Says is a production of Tribune Radio Networks. Coming up to 19 minutes before 6 o'clock, in addition to the other events I've mentioned, a lot of state conventions for FFA being held this month. Received my invitation from the reporter for the Illinois FFA saying, come to our convention in Springfield, the middle of the month. And so to all of the FFA chapters across the Midwest, have good conventions coming up. Coming up, we'll talk the dairy market with a first-timer here on the Saturday Morning Show. Max Armstrong will sit down with Ryan Yonkman to talk dairying when we continue on the Saturday Morning Show.
In June Dairy Month, we talk about the dairy situation this morning with Ryan Yonkman from Rice Dairy here in Chicago. First of all, welcome to our broadcast for the first time. Many of your colleagues have been here from Rice previously, but it's great to have you with us, Ryan. And a dairy farm product you are, we should hasten to point out.
I am, and I appreciate you guys having me in. Excited to be here today.
Where did you grow up on a dairy farm? Tell us about the farm.
Sure. So I grew up northern Michigan, a couple hours north of Grand Rapids, hour south of Traverse City for those who like to vacation that way. And we're currently still have the farm, milking close to 700 cows and actually in the middle of an expansion. So you can look at us and say we're half the problem, going from a double 10 to a rotary. So trying to survive with the rest of them.
We'll talk about those cow numbers in a moment, but I trust the folks sent you off to the big city to learn how to help them manage the various risks and hopefully improve the profitability of the farm.
Yeah, they did. It was an interest I kind of stumbled upon on my own, but when it had come to risk management, my dad, like a lot of older generation dairies, was not something that was part of his business plan growing up. So with my natural push to learn about it, it quickly became my role, and that is what I do for Yonkman Dairy today, along with a lot of other dairies around the country from the rice dairy side of things. And it's become a key piece in a year like last year and this year. Our risk management plan has really helped us be able to do things we're doing now, like grow when a lot of others can't.
When prices, the milk prices take the plunge that they have, It can be not just breathtaking, but doggone shocking for the business. And, of course, you no doubt watch the cost of the inputs, too, for the farm.
For sure. These are tough times. I think last year for a lot of dairies, we'd consider a break-even year, considering a dairy that was on the market. I think a lot of guys who had taken positions early, call it the hedger, probably had a profitable year last year. But to walk into this year, those guys that are on the market with no coverage are looking at negative profit margins and probably margins that are going to continue to sting for a while. So to be in a risk managed position like we are right now is certainly a big benefit and allows us to kind of take that that breath of fresh air a little bit, knowing we're going to be all right for the next few months as this thing plays out.
I know this is a little bit difficult because things are highly variable, but when you take a look at, a Michigan or Wisconsin dairy farm and tack on the premiums that farm could get, about where is, give us an approximate range, where is that milk price currently?
What premiums? I should say pertaining to Michigan. Two very different situations right now when you look at Wisconsin versus Michigan, to be honest. Michigan, as I think everyone can read, is really struggled with the ability to process the amount of milk we're making. And this is really about 2 years running now. So we're in a state right now where we need more processing capacity or we have to make less milk. So naturally, the premiums in Michigan, due to the oversupply of milk in our own little market, has really caused those premiums to erode. To make a comparison to the Class 3 price, typically you could say a Michigan dairy is maybe $1 to $2 above that price. We've been coming in right around at the Class 3 price, if not under. And again, a lot of that having to do with the oversupply of milk in Michigan. Whereas if I flip across the lake, jump across the pond there and look at a Wisconsin dairy, due to all the cheese capacity they have there, I see a Wisconsin dairy being able to take better opportunity premiums right now just due to their ability to handle the milk. So you're looking at more of a Class 3 plus situation. So really interesting just as you go around the country to look at the microeconomic situations, if you will, of certain states to see the differences. And right now Michigan is certainly toward the bottom of the barrel with premiums we're getting for our milk right now.
What would that price be in Wisconsin if you were to peg it?
So to lean on the last couple of months, okay, a Michigan dairy, I think generally speaking, is in that $13 to $14 range. If you're looking at a Wisconsin dairy, you're probably more in that $15 area. Again, getting a little extra premium for a state, I think, that can just handle the milk a little better. In a market that is almost all cheese, which is one of our dairy products that continues to be one of the strengths in our market, giving them that premium.
As a percent of decline from the peak, that's very substantial. It's got to be what? At least a third less, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess if you rewind to 2 years ago, 2014, a year that certainly overdid it, I think, to the upside with what China came in and bought kind of everything and sent us to $24, $25, $26 milk. There was dairies getting milk checks close to $30 after you tack on premiums. So you rewind today and you're at $15 from 2 years ago. That's a 50% retracement in your revenue. But I think understandably most dairies were able to look at 2014 and call that more of an anomaly than a trend. So you're certainly back into an area where I think we're more used to seeing milk historically trade.
When you look at those monthly figures, you always see that per cow output continuing to climb. You see the number of cows milked being ratcheted up generally when you look at the major milk producing states. There is a glaring exception right at the top of the list, and that's California, where they continue to curtail the milk output. Refresh our memory. What's going on there?
So I think, first of all, just to the point of making more milk per cow, you know, we're as good as you can find here in the United States. We're going to continue to become more efficient, better at taking care of our animals. And so I think that's a number that will probably continually grind higher. As far as going back to California and looking at, well, why is that state continue to decline while the rest of the U.S. maybe is steadily higher? California's had a rough go the last few years. You know, they're a state of large economics, a lot of big dairies. So when there's money to be made, there's a lot of it. But when prices move into areas where they have the last couple of years, some years of very high inputs and okay milk prices, some years of now of very low milk prices, okay inputs is leveraged a lot of those dairies to the point where some were foreclosed and just kind of forced out of the business. But you've got a lot of other dairies I learned that are just choosing to get out. There's a lot of other ways, I think, financially to be successful in California with the real estate they're sitting on. You know, you look at the tree market where a lot of these guys are shifting acres from grain crops into trees, selling cows to put trees in a market that's treated, I think, a lot of Californians a lot better.
But, you know, it's interesting to ponder what could happen there because the profitability is leaving the tree nut industry. They're expecting to have maybe one good year this year yet, and then after that, because they have boosted the output so much. We see that across agriculture quite often, do we not, including dairy, where we ratchet up the production so much so that it becomes unprofitable sometimes.
Yeah, without knowing really anything about that industry, I've always questioned myself, when is the bubble for that? Because you've certainly – it's been almost the popular thing to do with a lot of acres just shifting into it as if it was a sure win. But obviously the biggest reason for the California issues always boils down to the milk price, and it isn't. But every other day you can find an article talking about trying to join the federal order, trying to critique something to make them a little more competitive with the federal order, and still a very ongoing thing right now. To look at a relative California milk check, they're going to be around $1 to $2 under those Michigan, Wisconsin prices we were talking about. So it is a major setback. It's a tough one for those guys to battle, and even with all their efficiencies on the scales they do things, I think naturally they're able to. That's how they've been able to weather a lot of the storms. Prior, I think it's just worn on a lot of dairies and causing a lot of exit. But I think the thing to really understand with California being down on milk is those cows aren't just disappearing. Most of them tend to just cross over the border and head into another state.
Idaho has become a major milk producer.
Yeah, Idaho, even states like Colorado, you know, some of these places that have added new processing in the last few years have really been calling for the milk. And so you'll see a lot of these cows just move from California into states like that. You'll see a lot of the same owners in California just moving, you know, retaining ownership, but moving them into another state as far as South Dakota and Iowa. And so to your initial point of, you know, production up and total cow numbers up, a lot of those cows are just shifting east, if you will, into areas where it's a little easier maybe to grow feed and a little easier to find a profit margin on those cows.
Fluid milk consumption as a beverage continues to be a real problem for the industry, does it not? I mean, I'm doing my share, pal. Let the record show that I can't pass a convenience store without grabbing one of those little bottles. Generally speaking, with intense beverage competition, it's tough, isn't it?
It is, and I'm right there with you. I can't go a day without it. It certainly seems to be a market we've got to continue to learn, I think, to find ways to get that product to the consumer. I think companies like Fair Life are doing amazing things. You probably see that in about every store now, which is call it a high-end milk. I think they market it more of competitive, like with almond milk, something that's got the lactose out of it. So I think things like that are phenomenal for the industry.
Coca-Cola is a partner in that, are they not?
They are. So you've got these big beverage companies stepping into the dairy sector, which I think is probably a good thing. Obviously, Coke, a brand you can probably one of the most recognized brands around the world, you can maybe say. So to have them, I think, on the dairy side of it, helping a company like Fairlife get milk back on the shelf and hopefully getting it off the shelves is a good thing. And maybe that is a start to something new for Class 1 milk.
Talking about the situation for that dairy farm family, again, just going back to our earlier discussion, and you talked about the fact that you were expanding the operation back home, the Yonkman family is in northern Michigan, putting some of those profits earned a few years ago into capital investment. Did a lot of our dairy farm families indeed anticipate that things could be tougher on down the road? And did they save for that rainy day that certainly is here now?
You know, I would like to have think so. You know, after 2014, you know, call it the grand slam where milk did what it did. You would like to think dairies would have took that and paid down a lot of debt. There was an interesting article out, and I can't cite it right now, but it actually showed some graphics of how dairies are more leveraged today than they were in 2009, which I found very, very interesting. So you see things like that, and I guess you look at the milk production numbers, and it certainly shows us the U.S. continues to grow. So you know guys are reinvesting in their business. And so where we are right now, I would have a hard time thinking there's a lot of dairies on the brink of going out of business. I would think this would take a lot more time to be at these levels. But there's certainly information floating around that says otherwise.
It's great to talk to you, sir. Thanks for coming in to be with us. One thing I suppose that happens during these tougher times is we improve our risk management skills. We have to. You know, maybe those lofty prices made some producers a little bit lazy. We've seen that happen at the grain industry, for example.
For sure. You know, 20, 22, 24, 26, $28 milk. It was a phenomenal thing to have captured through the eyes of a risk manager. As soon as we saw that, red flags start flying all over the place of what the next 2 years could look like, understanding this was not something sustainable. And so I would hope that the general dairyman was able to see that and put themselves in some form of position for 2015 and hopefully going into this year as well. But certainly was a lot of opportunities. I think there was, I call the last 2 years some of the easier decisions made. There was a lot of writing on the wall and a lot of very good prices to where dairies, I think, could conservatively walk into a lot of risk management structures that really were pretty safe, generally speaking, but yet would put them in a much better position than they're probably seeing today if they're indeed on the market.
Ryan Yonkman, Rice Dairy in Chicago, helping dairy farmers manage their risk, and he knows it very well, knows the business very well, having grown up on a dairy farm in Michigan. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure having Ryan on the program for the first time. I do have to sit him down, though, and talk to him about one thing. There is no such thing as almond milk or soy milk. They are beverages, not milk, because I have milked a lot of dairy cows in my life. I have never milked a soybean plant. I have never milked an almond tree. So just want to get that one straightened out. Just a few more thoughts when we continue on the Saturday Morning Show. We are just 4 hours away from the Dairy Month Breakfast at Harvard Milk Days in Harvard, Illinois. Look forward to seeing a lot of you there this morning, and hope that you'll enjoy the event that continues through tomorrow. As always, we appreciate your company here on Saturday morning when Max Armstrong and I get together to talk agribiz, food, and all of the related topics that go with agriculture. So we've reached the 6 o'clock mark here on Chicago's very own WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.